Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Hello, I'm Tom Weber, and this hour on NPR News, the first of two conversations this week on the history and legacy of lynching.
Southern trees bear strange fruit.
The song Strange Fruit by the legendary Billie Holiday is probably the most well-known song that focuses on lynching. She recorded the song in 1939, when lynching was still very much in vogue. It's a pretty graphic song, too, when you concentrate on the lyrics. Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
From the poplar trees.
But in case you needed any reminder that lynchings were not just a Southern thing, we turn to Bob Dylan's song Desolation Row.
They're selling postcards of the hanging.
Which opens, "They're selling postcards of the hanging," a line that likely refers to the only known lynching of black people in Minnesota in Dylan's hometown of Duluth. On June 15, 1920, three circus workers were hanged at the corner of 1st Street and 2nd Avenue in downtown Duluth after a woman made a claim that she was raped by the man, a claim, by the way, which was never found to be valid, including by the doctor who examined her. Photos of the lynching were sold as postcards, which was not that rare of a thing to do with lynching photos, as I learned on the trip.
And so, we welcome you to the bus, and we just want to have, I think...
And it was from that very corner in Duluth where a memorial now stands to the three murdered men that a bus of nearly three dozen people departed last month from Montgomery, Alabama, to attend the opening of a new memorial to victims of lynching. It's called the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. NPR News photographer Evan Frost and I were on the bus as well. We will hear more from the Duluth group in a few minutes, but first, the story of two people who were not on the bus, but who are very much connected to what happened in Duluth.
Because I had no idea.
Warren Reed lives in Washington State. Virginia Houston lives in Missouri. They met more than a decade ago when Reed was researching his own family history and later a book that he wrote, The Lyncher in Me. It tells the story of Reed's discovery that one of his ancestors played a role in the Duluth lynching. His great-grandfather, Louis Dundino, helped incite the riots by driving a truck through Duluth, yelling to people to go to the necktie party.
My mother was really close to him. He passed away before I was born, but I'd heard a lot of stories about him growing up. My mother adored him, and so this was quite a stunning thing to find out. He actually served prison time for his role in the riots, and... you know, of course, it leaves a lot of unanswered questions that we'll probably never know the answers to.
In researching the lynching, Reed tried to find descendants of the men who were killed. He found Virginia Houston, who was unaware of this history until Reed contacted her. Elmer Jackson, one of the lynching victims, and Houston were both from Pennytown, which is a historically black town in central Missouri. The town doesn't exist anymore. None of the buildings are left except for one church.
It was a shock, but then, you know, we have to let go of the past and not blame anybody. We got to move forward, you know, in today's generation and everything, and let God control everything. And we as human beings not look at the color of the skin or, you know, we go by what's in everybody's heart and realize it and make this a better place to live in.
Reed and Houston have stayed in touch over the years with Facebook messages and calls a few times a year. But here in Alabama, on Reed's 51st birthday, this was the first time in 6 or 7 years they'd been in each other's company. Warren Reed stands almost a foot taller than Virginia Houston. They were both wearing sneakers, a lot of walking to do on this day. As they walked for the first time into the memorial, that named her ancestor, Elmer Jackson, as a victim of lynching.
Well, it's a somber occasion and with mixed emotions, but I'm thankful that I'm able to come to do this in honor of Elmer and the other lynchings that would happen, not only him, but the other lynchings that happened. And that we just pray that some of these lynchings and some of these racial turmoils will end, you know. And so I will be praying before I go in there. So, and for peace, harmony, and love.
So. I think for me, you know, it's been almost 15 years since I first found out about this, and I've done a lot with this experience since then, and getting to know Virginia is one of the highlights. And I think I'm always surprised at the level of emotion that comes from this. You'd think I'd be used to it by now. But it's I'm glad we made this work out for us to be here together.
The main part of the memorial is an open-air room with 800 columns of steel, each 6 feet long, representing a county in the United States where at least one lynching occurred. Some columns have just one name, others have more than 20. As you walk through the memorial, the floor slowly descends while the columns, which start out at eye level, stay at the same height. This has the effect of you eventually walking amidst columns that are hanging above you, as, say, a lynching victim might have hanged above the masses from a tree or a light pole or a bridge. Most of the columns inside that main memorial are dedicated to the southern states where a lion's share of lynchings happen. So the column with Elmer Jackson, Isaac McGee, and Elias Clayton's name on it isn't in here. It's just outside in an area called Monument Park. This is where those that couldn't fit inside are laying on the ground. There are also duplicates of every column that was inside out here. The idea is that communities should take ownership of their history and come get their duplicate column to bring back home and have a place of memory. Duluth plans to do that, by the way. After about a half hour of walking through that main part of the memorial, Virginia Houston and Warren Reed, descendant of a victim and perpetrator of a lynching, walking side by side, came up upon the column with the Duluth names on it.
I'm shedding tears right now, but they're not tears of... They're tears of remembrance to let them know that they will always be in my heart. And, you know, the past is the past. So we have to keep moving forward, and we'll just press on forward.
Did when you saw his name...
This one, the tears, yeah. Yeah, I thought I was going to be brave, and I thought I was going to be stronger than that. You know, I thought, oh, it's not, I'll be okay. But, you know, it's just something there, you know. But I don't hold no grudge or anything like that, you know. It's just things like that happened back in the day, so we have to move forward, yeah, and teach people to love one another.
You know, I think that our friendship speaks volumes to the fact that people can reach across the divide and apologize, and even if you didn't have a hand in specifically what happened, I think an apology and a reconciliation is important, because it brings to light all the things that were unspoken and that still exist.
And I saw you get emotional there too.
Oh yeah. Well, and it's, you know, and it's the moment. I mean, it's not like it's new information. I mean, it obviously, this was a long ago discovery, and Virginia and I have talked about this a lot. But I think it's just the reality of it. And it's in this environment. I mean, really just seeing how many names and how many locations the lynchings happened. And, you know, on one hand there, Elmer Jackson is one name of many, but it's so important to put a human face on this, on these victims, because, you know, it's, I think that's, these kinds of crimes happen, these atrocities happen because they are dehumanized and anonymous, and to put that human face on it and recognize that these were people who were loved and had families that experienced great loss when this happened, but that loss can carry on from generation to generation. And so, I mean, yeah, it's kind of a flood of stuff, I guess.
I don't hold no grudge or anything like that, you know. It's just things like that happened back in the day, so we have to move forward, yeah, and teach people to love one another, yeah.
Well, thank you.
That's Warren Reed in Virginia Houston. Last month, at the opening of the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama, it's the new memorial that commemorates more than 4,000 victims of lynching. Reed was there with his husband, Shane. Houston was there with her sister, Sheila. Warren Reed also wrote to me in an email yesterday and said one thing that keeps coming up in the weeks since being in Alabama was the experience of walking through the memorial with Virginia, looking for the Duluth marker and realizing the seamlessly endless crowd of markers, that ours is one of thousands of stories, is so humbling and tragic.
Lift every voice and sing, till earth and heaven ring. Ring with a harmony of liberty.
Tom Weber on NPR News. As I noted earlier, this is the first of two conversations we're having this week about the legacy of lynching in relation to this trip that that group took from Duluth to Alabama. The second of those conversations will be Thursday at 11 with our next conversation from Counter Stories. For the rest of this hour, more on the legacy of lynching, more from the group that went there from Duluth, and of course, your calls. The organization that researched lynching so it could put all those names together on those columns is the Equal Rights Initiative. Kira Boone is Deputy Program Manager at EJI and joins me on the phone from Montgomery. Kira, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And Carl Crawford is with me. He is the Human Rights Officer for the City of Duluth and was on the trip. Good to talk to you again, Carl. How are you?
Thanks, Tom. Good to hear from you again.
I hope to hear from our listeners as well. Your questions, 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000. I sent a note yesterday to those who were on the trip. I hope some of you who were on that bus will call and share your reflections as well. 800-242-2828. 651-227-6000. You can also tweet me at WeberTom1. And please don't call or text if you're driving. Kira, the question I'm sure you've been asked in every interview you've done about this is, why do this? It's in the past. Why dig this up? It's a shameful part of our history. Why do this?
It's a great question, and it is one that we often get, and I think it speaks to the heart of why we know that these spaces and acknowledging this history is important. For us, if we're going to be able to get to healing and reforms in the areas in our society that we need, we have to understand how these injustices and these challenges were created. And for so long, we've done a very good job of sweeping our history under the rug, of not talking about it, of not acknowledging it, or only glossing over some of the bad parts. And that hasn't allowed for us to be very truthful. And so these spaces and the research and inviting people to engage with this history in a very tangible way are aimed at allowing us to be able to push through that difficult truth-telling work to be able to get to justice today. And what justice looks like can take a lot of different forms in a lot of different areas, but we know that without this comprehensive understanding of our past, we can't move forward together.
You know, as you know, I'm sure you know from the history here, Black people were not the only people lynched in this history of when lynching was so much more commonplace. Mexicans were on the list, Native Americans, even white people. White people were definitely lynched at points in the history. We could certainly make the list there, Kira. So why focus with this memorial and the museum specifically on Black lynching?
So the museum, the Legacy Museum, From Enslavement to Mass Incarceration, follows the thread of the African-American experience in this country and making the argument and showing the connections between these different eras. We have to understand the parameters of injustice that happened to this community in order to understand the challenges that we see today in this modern-day era of mass incarceration. And our research, as you know, is limited to the lynchings of African-Americans, precisely because we are showing those connections between those eras. And we we think that that's important. And in the museum, you also get a chance to understand the connections between the injustice that other groups have seen, whether it be Mexican-Americans, Asian-Americans, or whomever, to this history, but through the lens of slavery to mass incarceration through the African-American experience. But we definitely look forward to seeing continued research into the phenomenon of American lynching that others will continue to do.
Kira Boone is with me from the Equal Justice Initiative. Yeah, excuse me, from Montgomery, Alabama. Carl Crawford from the city of Duluth. He was on this trip that I was also on this bus trip from Duluth to Montgomery to attend the opening of this memorial last month. And we're taking your questions as well, 1-800-242-2828. Carl, what are your reflections? We're a few weeks back now. I know the group has gotten together a couple times. In your day-to-day, when people ask you about the trip, or maybe you're just sitting there in your office, what do you think about?
Hi, Tom. It's amazing. I'm still going through the full gamut of emotions, from being excited to come and see the CJM Memorial there, but also torn between we're coming to pay homage to lynching and the pain and the horrible crime that it was, but it's an untold story that is finally being told. And, Kira, I can't thank you and your committee enough for the amazing job that you did in bringing peace to many people whose lives were literally taken from them. I encourage everyone to just go see the memorial, go to the museum, and gain your own understanding. I grabbed so many nuggets that, to be honest, Tom, they're still coming up in different times throughout the day. But what an amazing experience, and one that I believe every American should go see.
And Montgomery is such an interesting place. And Kira, you live there now, and you work there. I mean, I didn't even recall. I don't even think I remembered learning this, that Montgomery was the first capital of the Confederacy, but it's also such an important city in what the civil rights movement did in the 60s. Martin Luther King preached at a church there right by the Capitol. It was also a very important port for bringing in slaves. I mean, I don't know how a city like Montgomery wrestles with so much that's so conflicting. Do you have any thoughts there, Kira?
I think what we saw in Montgomery, which is similar to a lot of communities, that if there is some acknowledgement of the history, it's often controlled by those who are in positions of power. And one of the things that Montgomery has been doing for several decades, as you note, with those historical sites, is trying to tell those stories. And so when we started talking about the history of Montgomery, particularly with regards to the domestic slave trade, one of the things we realized is that we had a lot of information about the Confederacy and about Montgomery's role, but we had very little information about people who were enslaved and that history from the perspective of those who were oppressed. And so our challenge in Montgomery has been a ways to be comprehensive and truthful in contextualizing our full history. And I think the museum and the memorial and the work that EJI and other groups here are doing is helping to fill out that full narrative, which will hopefully be something that we continue to see throughout the nation, because there are these different parts, but we have to be committed to telling the truth about this history, and that's often quite difficult, especially when we begin to try to make those connections for folks between our past and our present.
And Carl, as you know, Duluth is largely an exception to the rule in terms of the lynching history, because it actually has erected a memorial to the lynching that happened in Duluth. If you're in downtown Duluth and you're at the Fond Duluth Casino, if you know where that is, just walk one block up the hill, and that is the site of where that lynching took place in 1920. Now that you're back from Alabama, Carl, do you feel that that memorial there to the Duluth lynching needs to be revisited, reworked at all, or is it fine the way it is, and we just known also that there'll be that second memorial in Alabama?
I think it's fine the way it was and the way it is, and the reason I say that is because it's now our responsibility of those that went on the trip to come back and relive the importance of why we're doing this work and why it's still relevant today. You know, and I'm sure, Kira, your group is probably understanding like we did. When that last paver went in the ground at our memorial, that's when the real work began. educating community, getting people involved, and not just allowing our conscience to walk by and not see this and not stop and change our way of life. And I think that's why it's important that it stays the way it is, because it was accepted by the community.
Right.
And I think any change to it, once again, you have to re-explain.
What about also the fact that what this memorial and what EJI is doing in Alabama is creating duplicates? They're saying, look, we're going to have these big columns here with the names of people who've been lynched, and all those counties that are listed, we have an extra one here for you to come anytime you want. When you're ready to acknowledge that history, take the column back to your hometown and put it on display there. So Duluth, Carl, has overwhelmingly said, yes, this is something we're going to do. Has that process, by the way, even started? Are you aware of any logistics that have happened on bringing back that column to Duluth?
We have just scratched the surface of having that conversation. Of course, we're going to include our Duluth Arts Commission as well as the CJM board and talk about where we think that should go in our community. And more importantly, what are we going to be able to say around that column to bring more importance, even as EJI pointed out, the lynching that's still happening today with the children to prison pipeline.
And it might not. So well, one thing I heard in that answer there, Carl, is that column might not actually go in the space where the current memorial is. Is that right?
I believe that's true.
So we will see. We don't know where in Duluth. Stay tuned for sure. Carl Crawford here from the city of Duluth. He's the human rights officer there. Kira Boone from the Equal Justice Initiative as well. Want to hear your calls, 800-242-2828, your questions about this experience. And you can tweet me at WeberTom1. You know, when you're inside the museum there, Kira, there is a screen on one of the walls with data and statistics scrolling through. And I caught one series of statistics there, screens there. One screen noted that between 1877 and 1950, there were 355 lynchings in Texas. 355, keep that number in mind. The very next screen then notes that since 1976, 543 legal executions have been held in Texas. As a side note, I looked it up. Most of those executions have actually been of white men. However, it's important to also note that the percentage of black men executed far exceeds the percentage of black population in Texas. I have to guess that was a deliberate juxtaposition. Why? What is the purpose of that juxtaposition, Kira?
So, again, in the Legacy Museum, the name is what we want people to take away, that connection between our history to what's happening in our present-day lives. And for us, there is that direct line between the history of racial terror lynching and our modern-day capital punishment system. When we think about the disparities between how capital punishment is applied in this country, we definitely see racial disparities and class disparities being at the forefront of those issues. And so we want people to have the information and the context and to do what you did, which is additional research, but also be able to understand that the way we think about the criminal justice system today and the way it functions is definitely connected to this history and how we treated and didn't protect all of our citizens. And so as an organization that got its start doing death penalty work here in Alabama, we understand that the reforms and the justice that we're seeking for our clients requires us to have a broader conversation, a broader understanding of the historical connections to these injustices. And that's why you see that in the museum, you see that in the reports that we produce, and why you hear our director often say that lynching is a direct connection, often talking about the death penalty as a step away from lynching.
You know, and Brian Stevenson is the director and founder you're referring to. He's an attorney who, among other things, has gone to court for people who have been wrongly convicted, wrongly put on death row. Does that argument hold up in court? In other words, if he stands in a courtroom and says that the criminal justice system we have today can be directly drawn with a thick line back to slavery by way of segregation and lynching, I mean, how does that land with different audiences when that connection is made?
Mm-hmm. And I think the one of the aims of our public education is to continue to help the public make these connections so that when you're in court, oftentimes courts are responsive to public opinion. And I think also there is a lot of new learning or unlearning that we as a nation have to do when it comes to our history, because we've been exposed to one version and one isolated version for so long. And so when we're making those claims about racial disparity, about racial bias in the criminal justice system and the courtroom, it depends on the case and it depends on the court. But one of the things that we are committed to doing is to making sure that we make that argument, because it is always present in many of the cases that we're looking at, particularly when we're talking about wrongful convictions and the unfair application of sentences in some of these more extreme cases.
And
to Mr. Crawford's point about making those lines between how we treat children in the criminal justice system from the past, people like George Stinney and the three men who were lynched in Duluth, to today's system isn't that far-fetched when you look at the way in which the systems have evolved over time.
Is there any part, and just for people who haven't yet been there, the museum we're talking about and the memorial are two separate spots within Montgomery. The museum is really more in downtown Montgomery, and then on the edge of downtown is where this memorial stands, and we were taking shuttles between the two. Carl, from the museum portion, not the a lot of attention goes on the memorial with these hanging columns, but from the museum portion, I do think you were able to get in, right?
Yes.
What sticks out from that museum?
You know, number one, the enormous impact it had on me was the statistics like you read, but also there was one thing that caught my eye, a gentleman who was first African-American in one of the high schools there, and it was actually a graduation letter that the class wrote to him not to show up to the graduation. And that stayed in my heart, seeing that now is graduation time, and how many people, especially people of color, don't attend or don't go through that ceremony of graduation, not fully understanding what so many have went through for them to even walk on that campus. So that really resonated with me a lot. But the museum was so well done, to be honest, I could only make it through almost half of it.
Yeah,
because it was so impactful. But this is knowledge and information we have to have.
You know, one of the features of the museum portion, Kira, as I talked to Kira Boone from the Equal Justice Initiative and Carl Crawford from the city of Duluth, who was on this trip from Duluth to Alabama, is there is this this wall of, I think it's 280 jars, where each jar contains soil from either the site of a lynching or the grave site of a lynching victim, and then that person's name is on the front of the jar. And so you just see this wall of jars of dirt and then names on front. Well, when we found the Duluth jars, there were three of them, we actually found an interesting thing, because one of the victims was mislabeled, misidentified. Nathan Green, when we were there, was the name on the jar, and it should have been Elmer Jackson. We found out from Warren Reed, who you heard earlier there, that actually in one of the early newspaper reports, Nathan Green was named instead of Elmer Jackson. Mm-hmm. First of all, just to give people an update who were in the museum, has that jar, has that been updated? Has the correction been made there?
Yes, it has. It has. And in other places, I saw in the kiosk where we have information about the lynching victims, and as well as in the memorial, the Elmer Jackson's name was there.
Yeah.
As Mr. Reed points out, some of the earlier newspaper articles, and so at an earlier point in our research, that was fabricated and slated to be replaced, but was missed during the first opening days. But it is now correct. And I think that also brings to light another challenge that we see with doing this research, and that oftentimes the mainstream press's coverage of these lynching events and data wasn't something that would hold up to journalistic integrity by today's standards, I would imagine. And so there are inherent challenges in trying to uncover and verify this history, but it's important that we do. And that's why when we talk about our research, it definitely builds on the work that many other historians and others have been doing, but we also had to go out into a lot of communities to get these contemporary documents firsthand that weren't digitized, that weren't available other places. And we always stress that the numbers that we have are the ones that were reported in some way, that were documented, and we know that there are many more lynchings that are not uncovered in our research. And we anticipate that this list of names and locations will continue to expand. And it is our hope, and it is our duty to continue to evolve the research as we learn more and as we continue to involve others in this process with us.
And you noted it there in your answer, Kira, but I thought that was actually an almost fitting part of the trip to actually have an error in the jar, because as you noted, the idea that these people who were lynched were already, I mean, putting it lightly, treated so horribly that whether or not we identified them correctly didn't seem to be a priority. We're talking here with Kira Boone from the Equal Justice Initiative, Carl Crawford from the city of Duluth as well. And Carl, just for people who know, there's a sidebar here that we made several stops along the way before we got to Montgomery. We went to Cairo, Illinois, where another lynching took place. We were in Memphis, where the hotel where Martin Luther King Jr. was shot has now been made into a museum. We were also in Birmingham as well. And we had to do some sleeping on the bus, too. Carl was not that comfortable. But just all of that together, the importance, especially of Cairo, going to a place where another lynching had occurred. What stands out for you there?
The most amazing thing that stands out is the family, the couple that stopped as we were standing where the lynching took place. Another couple drove by and stopped and spent time with us to talk to us more about the history of that community and what happened there. But I thought the other important thing was here we are in a town where this lynching is not being recognized, going on an amazing journey to where many lynchings are recognized. And the contrast between the two were amazing.
The Kira, up here at NPR, we, back before I worked at NPR, some colleagues, former colleagues, produced a documentary about the Duluth lynching. This was back in 2001, and it was called Postcard from a Lynching. And it was interesting, especially in Cairo, to learn that the idea that photographs of lynchings were made into postcards was not at all unique to Duluth. We heard the Bob Dylan song earlier, Desolation Row, not at all unique. Cairo also had postcards made. And then I find out on Fresh Air last week, back from a 2000 interview, a guy named James Allen wrote a book called Without Sanctuary, Photographs and Postcards of Lynching in America. He notes that there was one postcard in Texas where a guy named Joe Myers wrote this postcard to his mom, sent this photo to his mom, and on the other side wrote, "This is the barbecue we had last night." What other similarities did EJI find, Kira, when researching lynchings that suggests that these were not one-off events, that they were patterns? Did you find that there was almost a how-to manual on how to lynch?
So, and I also want to note that many people may also remember that the Without Sanctuary book was made into a traveling exhibit, and I think one of the first places that it was on display was in Atlanta. And so people actually had a chance to come into an exhibit space and encounter and engage those postcards in real space. So it's very jarring as well. And I think what we documented in our research that helps us to know that we're dealing with this sort of this what we call this era of racial terrorism are the ways in which there were similarities. So we spend a great deal of initial research looking at lynchings in the Deep South, because that's where they were the most prevalent. But even the ones outside of the South, in places like Illinois and Minnesota, but we saw all these hallmarks of similarities. Some of that was the motivations for lynchings, whether it be allegation of a crime. So instead of allowing the criminal justice system to take place, people being kidnapped from jails, not being protected by law enforcement. These public spectacle lynchings where people from the entire community would come and watch and take part in the killings of these people and the souvenirs that were taken from their bodies and the ways in which it was just an absolute dehumanization of people or things that we saw across the board, as well as the ways in which the newspapers and many accounts, there's a man named John Hartfield from Ellisville, Mississippi, where the local newspaper basically makes an advertisement about the fact that the lynching will take place. So it wasn't just sort of post-lynchings. These are also things that are announcements almost. And I guess the total disregard for life are things that became very apparent in the research.
And Carl, one of the things about being taken from the jail, that happened in Duluth. And do I have this right, that there were three men lynched in Duluth, but there were actually six in the jail? Is that right,
that's
Carl?
Correct.
They only
that
got three
correct.
Out?
There was actually, I believe, and I don't want to get the number wrong, but I think it was 13 that were taken off the train. And the others were diverted to Virginia, Minnesota. But there were six in the Duluth jail. And one thing that we haven't had a chance to talk about, and that is the trauma that happened to the families that stayed in those communities where lynching took place.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that that exists. And there's trauma on both sides of the black community and the white community that witnessed this devastating crime. And it resonated in that community. And many folks that I ran into, actually who knew of relatives that were lynched, talked about many conversations at the dinner table about the pain and what had happened.
That was something, Kira, I also got out of the museum. And I think you alluded to earlier about how do we teach? What are we teaching, especially in places like schools? So I distinctly remember, you know, this era called the Great Migration, when so many so many black people from the South moved to the North. I was taught in school that was all about jobs. And I think that legitimately that is true. It was about jobs. But EJI... Yeah. suggests perhaps that we teach that a little differently. What would we add to that lesson, Kira?
We would add the context about the violence, the lynching, the humiliation that people were enduring in the South. And so in addition to the accounts of racial terror lynchings that we've documented, we also note what we've been referring to as near lynchings, these incidents that happened where people were so frightened by the possibility of mob violence that they fled to places like Chicago and St. Louis and New York. And to talk about the migration of people, of black people from this region to the North and the West and the Midwest without this context around this violence, I think disrupts our understanding of what people endured when they got to these communities and the continued violence and the continuation of Jim Crow laws that we saw devastate those communities. And that trauma of endured separation from families and what that meant for familial bonds and why, again, when people engage in genealogical research, particularly in the African-American context, it's already a challenge because you're looking for information about people who were the children of enslaved Africans, and so there's already a gap there. And then when you have this increased movement and people being forced by violence, the information and the documentation is greater. And so to have the historical lens to understand what was happening helps to explain more of the totality of the trauma and the reality of the situation.
I want to play a piece of audio from someone else in Duluth that you know, Carl, very well.
Yes.
The police chief, Mike Tuskin, who has a connection with history. You know, it's so interesting because the estimates for the Duluth lynching, the anniversary of which is next month, almost exactly a month from now, 10,000 people were at the lynching in Duluth. At the time, if you look up the records, Duluth had a population of about 100,000. And so it's so interesting to think that if you're from Duluth and you know that you have grandparents or great-grandparents or great-aunts who were alive in 1920 and you're white, there's a 1 in 10 chance that your relative was at that lynching. And Mike Tuskin, the police chief, learned about this piece of family history back in the 1990s when Duluth was preparing to build this memorial that now stands called the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial. His mother took him aside and told him about Tuskin's great-aunt, who he knew growing up.
It's going to come out that our family was associated with this, and your great aunt was the female who reported the rape, that was kind of the impetus for then the riots and, of course, the lynchings. And I was completely, I to say I was shocked would be putting it mildly. I was just, I said, the question I ask, of course, immediately is, well, how come nobody said anything until now? I said, I work for the police department in this city. How many other people knew and I didn't in the community? And what a disadvantage to be at, right?
Specifically in the Black community, like how many people might know the Tuscan name and in addition to all the other conversations we're having about police, see you as a police officer.
Correct. Right. So not only there's the police part of, you know, the history of policing in America, there has been many times where police have marginalized and at times victimized people of color and especially the African-American community to have this secret that I couldn't do anything to change because I didn't know about it. I was the one that didn't know about it, the secret. That was very difficult. And it really took me years to come to terms with it. I would say initially I felt shame, so much so that I really... I didn't know how to act. So how do you account for literally the sins of your lineage or your past? And now, although it wasn't me, I think everyone has some sense of ownership for their lineage and for the good and the bad that comes from family.
What happens, Carl, if someone else, like a Mike Tuscan, who has a long family history in Duluth, starts to do that kind of genealogy research and also discovers... maybe not as direct a connection as Mike Tuscan's relative had to the lynching, but even that they were there. Maybe Grandpa, who you loved growing up, right? All these great memories, but then you learn this moment of like, oh my gosh, what if Grandpa was at that lynching? What are you finding people discovering that? I mean, what do they do with that, Carl?
We have found people who have discovered that, and the key thing, Tom, is at least I try to let folks know that blame is a wasted emotion when you're doing this kind of work. And I'm very proud of our police chief, and Mayor Larson says hello. But one thing to keep in mind, that it took courage. He very easily could not address this issue. But the challenge is we're not responsible for what happened in the past, but we are responsible for what happens in the future. And once we learn this knowledge, how are we going to move forward? And that's something that I found out working with the memorial. We had many families come up and point out that was their uncle or someone in the picture on the mat on front of the cover and said that was one of my relatives. So I found that to be able to move forward from blame to a part of reconciliation and atonement is the key. But we get stuck in blame sometimes. We can't live there. We can't move forward there.
What would you add to that, Kira?
Yeah, I agree. And one of the things that we often note at EJI is that these spaces, this acknowledgement of this history is to liberate us. We are an organization that spends a lot of time in courtrooms talking on behalf of our clients. And one of the things that becomes apparent in our system is that we want people to acknowledge and to accept responsibility for their actions. And I think we see value in us acknowledging our past. And one of the things that the police chief in Troup County, Georgia, in LaGrange, where a man named Austin Calloway was lynched, said when he apologized on behalf of the police department's responsibility in Mr. Calloway's lynching decades ago was that institutions are made up of people. And people, in order for us to trust those institutions, we have to build relationships. And so if we know that we have this injury to the relationship, however long ago that it happened, it should be our commitment to trying to acknowledge and to heal from it. In order to do that, we also have to talk about it and to acknowledge the pain and the injury that it caused. Because ignoring it invalidates people's experiences and it only perpetuates inequalities that we continue to see. And so if we want to be liberated from this past, we have to acknowledge it.
Kira Boone with us from the Equal Justice Initiative. Carl Crawford from the city of Duluth, who was on this bus trip we've been talking about from Duluth to Montgomery as we talk about the legacy of lynching. And another person who was on the bus has just called in, Portia Johnson, a well-known civil rights activist in Duluth. Actually has a road named after her in Duluth, if you're keeping score at home. Portia, I'm so glad you called in. What have you been thinking about in the weeks since we got home?
You know, hi, Tom. Thank you for acknowledging me. You know, it made me a little angry you know, being there and seeing some of the sights, you know, but I am truly grateful and that I was allowed to go on that trip to see other parts of what has happened to other people. You know, there were so many, it was like coffins at the memorial. And that didn't have names, and they were lynched, you know, at the same time, the same day, and all it just says is unknown.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that to me was scary to see that. Although I knew about quite a few lynchings, and I didn't grow up in the South. I grew up in Ohio, but both of my parents grew mm-hmm. up in the South. So I had heard about some lynchings growing up and, you know, to be careful, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I tell you, the one thing that stood out in my mind is when we stopped in Cairo, Illinois.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether anyone spoke of it or not, but it was the black man who got lynched, and it was all women who did the lynching of him. You know, that was surprised me. And, and they had a party. They had a great big party around this, but there is nothing to indicate that this ever happened on the spot where it happened. There's absolutely nothing. We couldn't find anything to show that this lynching actually happened, but it is in a book.
Yeah.
That Heidi Bach has, and it says at the docks, it says this is the gateway to the South, and it's where they brought slaves in. Ohio River?
Yeah.
I believe.
Right.
There
was this thinking that if you could cross the Ohio at Cairo, you'd be in Illinois, you'd be in the North, you'd be free, but that's
right.
That's not the case. If someone was sympathetic to the South, found you, they could get you back across the river, and
mm-hmm.
you'd be
that's
back.
That's true.
You'd be
that
back.
That is
in the
so
South.
Very true. And, you know, there was another town called Anna.
Yeah. Anna, Illinois.
Anna, Illinois. And you know what the letters stand for?
I do. I don't
I
know.
I do if... also. So should I say what, you know, your people who are listening to this, they should know anyway. Anna is spelled A-N-N-A, and it stands for Ain't No Niggers Allowed. Mm-hmm. And it still stands to this day. And it still says that, you know. And Anna isn't that far from Cairo,
yeah.
Illinois. And the fact that black people have to drive 30 miles
to
their
to
job.
Work. Yeah.
That live there. It's almost like a ghost town.
Yeah.
You know, Kira, and people are still afraid
and
to this day.
And Kira, I think, and I'm so glad Portia said that, but I also think about a wider conversation about public spaces. The Sherilyn Ifill, who was at this opening weekend mm-hmm. event, one of the panel discussions. She heads the NAACP Legal Defense. She's actually working with Starbucks right now after that incident in Philadelphia where two black men who were waiting for another man to show up and hadn't ordered mm-hmm. anything were arrested. And Sherilyn said this in an interview recently. Most of us have had this experience in the public space of being treated as if we don't belong there, of being treated suspiciously, of being treated as though we're criminals, and it's deeply humiliating. I don't know if it's too much of a stretch, or maybe not at all, to say that the history of black space for black people, and I wonder if there's actually a connection between lynching and what happened in that Starbucks. Or is that maybe a little too far, Kira?
No, I don't think it's too far at all. I think what you're touching on are the narratives that we have created about black people that allow for a lynching to take place or for the arrest of those two gentlemen in that Starbucks. And so those narratives about these presumptions around how dangerous black people are, how guilty they are, and the need to expedite these certain types of responses is deeply rooted in how we have shaped these stereotypes about blackness. And that's how you get to a point where you are able to look at another human being and not see them as an equal and get to that point of dehumanization. And so I think that bias piece is something that you do see from both spaces. And I just wanted to note from Ms. Johnson's reflections about the space at the memorial, those unknown lynchings that we document are some of are ones that we were able to document, maybe even some of the more gruesome details, but there was no name recorded. And so as our research continues, it's our hope that we'll be able to add names. But for now, there are so many that we don't know the names of. And that's different from the unknown unknowns, the ones that there is no documentation at all, but whose family members just never saw them again. And that's heartbreaking.
Final question for you, Kira. If EJI has built a memorial to lynching victims all these decades after what we would call the heyday of lynching, does that mean we'll have a Memorial Day, memorial one day to black people shot by police?
So one of the things at the memorial that you saw through the inclusion of the sculptures, whether it be the Unchinchemic piece about slavery from a West African sculpture to the piece about the Montgomery bus boycott to the raised up piece by Hank Willis Thomas, is this connection to all these pieces. And I think that when we create spaces that allow for that reflection and that contemplation, we get closer to some form of justice and some form of accountability. So I think we could.
I want to thank you for your time, Kira Boone from the Equal Justice Initiative. It was certainly a busy weekend when we were down there, so I hope you got a couple days off since then, but I really appreciate you taking time to join us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And Carl Crawford, last word to you. Final thoughts here in our last 30 seconds or so. What happens next, especially in Duluth? I know they've been having some meetings about this.
We come home with a new mission, with a new spirit of sharing and changing our communities by talking about the memorial, but also encouraging people to go. So I think in the future, we're going to try and get another group to go down to the memorial and retrace those steps because it's life-changing.
Carl Crawford is the human rights officer for the city of Duluth, one of the nearly three dozen people who were on this bus trip from Duluth to Montgomery, Alabama, to see the opening of this. Carl, thanks so much for your time. It's good to hear from you again.
Likewise, Tom. Thank you.
And more of our stories about this are on our website. I've been doing a lot of reporting. Evan Frost, our photographer, as well. A lot of photography as well. Head over to nprnews.org. And as I noted, this is the first of two conversations about lynching this week on the 11 o'clock hour. So come back on Thursday. We'll have our latest conversation from Counter Stories.
Look what I'm whipping up. Look how I'm geeking up. Hey. I'm so fitted. I'm on Gucci.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.